From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's good to have an old friend back. It's 21 years of the show. It's nice to have friends do the show. And our old friend Jordan Peele is back with his first film as director, Get Out. I'm sorry, I'm not addressing him. I'm actually using the title of the film.
Okay,
but we're just talking about...
Because I was about to leave.
I'm sure you're ready to leave anyway. But the difference for black audiences and white audiences in horror films, and this is the old Eddie Murphy joke, but since black people don't get cast in horror films anyway, the joke we always make is that we left before things broke off.
That's right. You know, it would be a good a black horror short film festival, because there's just no, you know, after the first 5 minutes... Any black person in their right mind would excuse themselves from the situation.
Excuse? What a politic way to put it.
Excuse themselves from the situation. Or as Eddie Murphy put it, too bad we can't stay, baby. yeah, it's this. I'm glad you started talking about this, because a big piece of what this movie was to me was to serve the loyal African-American horror fan base.
That goes out to see every horror movie.
You know, horror is the way we deal with our demons, and those of us who are most oppressed and face real-life horrors the most, I think, are more inclined to be pulled towards horror films.
And to laugh at them, because you bring a sense of irony to them, don't you?
And a sense of relief, a sense of release. We need to laugh, you know, we need to laugh at the darker sides of the human condition of life, and that's one of the reasons also I think that comedy, that horror was such a natural place for me to take, you know, everything I've learned as a comedian.
Well, so much about comedy anyway is about building tension and about kind of a sense of dread, because you're waiting to see when something's going to pay off.
Yeah.
And so it involves audiences in the same way that horror does, doesn't it?
That's really great observation. It's about tension building and release. It's about being able to pinpoint exactly what your audience is feeling and what they're thinking at every moment, so you can give them that release. You know, I feel that in a lot of ways, horror and comedy and that pattern of tension and release is a metaphor for our own life and death, and that, you know, life is a long, winding tension towards this inevitable, absurd, unknown that is the release of death. And so I think that's why comedy and horror are so visceral as genres, as art forms.
And so much of black comedy is really about observation of the horrible. I mean, as compared to more mainstream comedies, it's about understanding our place in this country. And if we don't laugh at it, it will seem like a real horror movie anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, look, I mean, my comedic development is based on sort of juxtaposing SNL with In Living Color. In Living Color went to places SNL would not go. It was more irreverent. It was more messed up, and there was a sort of more of a catharsis, at least for me and many people at that time. I mean, I'm sure that's why, you know, that show came along and, you know, took the Emmy from SNL in that time, and that was a big moment. So yeah, you're right. You know, I think who we are and our identity really does affect how we experience these different genres.
Because it felt to me as much as a philosophical statement as it is a piece of entertainment. I was wondering if that was something that you were carrying along with you as you were shaping and writing the piece.
Yeah, you know, I tried to build many layers into the film, but I think on the most philosophical, you know, this movie is about neglect of a conversation. It's about neglect of a certain real life horror. It's about the the mass incarceration of African Americans in some metaphorical level, but it's also about the lack of representation. And It felt like to me like it was a missing piece of the genre, of the conversation, to allow us to see in this fun popcorn movie to intertwine the black experience with that.
If you could tell the audience what the movie's about without giving too much away.
Yeah, it's basically Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but the horror version.
That's someone who thought Guess Who's Coming Tonight was the horror version.
This one takes it up another notch. It's an interracial love story about a guy who goes up with his white girlfriend, a black guy, goes up to meet her family and feels isolated and increasingly uncomfortable with how welcome he is there. And then, you know, much like my favorite movies, Rosemary's Baby and The Stepford Wives, creep towards this.
It's definitely, yeah. I didn't want to say too much. I'm trying to stay away from this.
We'll just say it creeps towards an inevitable, nightmarish end that is crazier than we can imagine.
And it's even funny, too, in the casting, because you cast people who audiences, through, say, the white actors, who people will have a certain sort of comfort with, from Bradley Whitford to Catherine Keener, to even having George's boss from Seinfeld.
Yeah, Richard Hurd is up in there. Yeah,
yeah. To Allison Williams. Just there's a level of comfort that a lot of the white cast will sort of engender for audiences that really sort of adds to the creepiness of the enterprise.
That's right. It would have been very easy, or I think too easy to create a movie that, you know, took, you know, where you had a sort of menacing white family, or a family that you would expect to be racist in some way. I really wanted to, you know, make this movie about the false sense of security, and, you know, cast these sort of, you know, liberal heroes, you know, in Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener as the villains in this film.
But it's also too really about sublimation and really how the black gaze is adopted by the mainstream. I mean, it's the number of metaphors in this film, given how fast it moves and what you do, I was really struck by it.
Thank you, man. I knew. It's like, I was like, Elvis is going to get this. Elvis is going to get this one. Yeah, you know, it's I think a scene that really hits its stride is this party scene, where we have Chris, who's the lone black guy, or he believes it as much, at the party with a bunch of, Rose's grandparents' friends, who are, you know, elderly white people who are very nice and very welcoming, but they're fascinated by Chris's blackness, and they want to connect with him on whatever black sort of topic they can. This is something that, you know, makes the audience very uncomfortable, but it rings true because it is true, and it's a I think one of the things that's uncomfortable is it's very familiar, and it's sort of sinister to think of the relationship with this seemingly harmless form of prejudice, to make that link with, you know, the entity that is like the racism monster.
Yeah, because I found myself thinking too that is in fact finding basically horror in the quotidian. That idea that, mm-hmm. you know, if you, any person of color who's dated somebody of another race and gone to that household, just the tension that comes, that in fact becomes its own kind of small scale horror movie.
Absolutely. You know, I think the real great horror movies not only deal with a true to life horror, but start with something, a fear that we can all understand and relate to. It's an art form when it's done best. It makes us look at life the way it is and see horror where maybe we had overlooked it.
It's a treat. I'm talking to an old friend who's back as a first-time director with his film Get Out, Jordan Peele. And I guess one of the things I want to ask you about, because the movie's about this as much as anything else, not, you don't see it when it's not done in a parodistic form, which is about, in fact, how living life as a black person in America is about having a kind of a meta-existence where your life is constantly commenting on itself.
Yeah. And there's a piece of the black experience of the experience of being a minority or an other in any way that endows you with a perceptiveness to a social dynamic that is unique, a sort of a sense. You know, I think a lot of you know, a lot of, you know, black people, minorities see this film and they go, somebody did it. Because this happened to me this morning. I think a lot of white people see this movie and go, oh, I might have said that this morning to that black guy who we were just talking to. I might have been a piece of that. Oh, that's so, you know, and of course, the point of this movie is not to say, like, you know, white people are racist and black people aren't. It's not that at all. In fact, you know, there are many assumptions, presumptions that the lead character makes that are wrong.
And his close friend make as well.
Yes, that are, you know, racially prejudiced presumptions. I think that's one of the pitfalls of marketing a film like this, is it looks like a total villainization of white people. And, you know, it is that in a little bit of a way. But I think, you know, what I believe race is a uniquely human – it is a uniquely human quality, or, you know, maybe not uniquely human. It's a part of our animal. It's a part of our DNA to categorize and to separate ourselves from one another. And it's something that every individual is guilty of, I believe, and has to, you know, constantly check and look within themselves as to – how they're dealing with it.
It's funny because I guess I think about so much of work you do in terms of comedy is about paranoia anyway. So it seems almost like the next logical step for you to make a horror movie about justifiable paranoia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, the question of am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing, or am I being paranoid is a very human experience. Is an experience that many black people have. I think many, you know, it's something that many women, I think, have as well. And it was used to great effect in Rosemary's Baby and the Stepford Wives, right? Rosemary, Mia Farrow, and Catherine Ross's character
in the Stepford Wives
are put in this position where they're trying to sort out, okay, is this just the normal messed up way the world works? Is that what I'm seeing? Or am I seeing through this into something darker? And in some ways, the feeling of paranoia is what keeps them from really being able to see in full force that this is run. get out of here. Maybe I'm just being paranoid. That is, I think, one of the reasons the identity of the other is a really valuable type of person to be a protagonist of a horror film.
Sure, but it's also, too, finally, a movie about loneliness.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Chris is really a lonely figure in this movie, and he doesn't have anybody he can really talk to. I mean, because even his best friend, And I don't want to give too much away, but there's this sort of seed of distrust that's kind of planted between them. So he's kind of really in a bubble. And there's that character, and you talked about Rosemary's Baby or the Stepford Wives, but so often in horror movies, that person who's like a lone flower that can be picked because there's really no support group around them.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something you knew from the outset you were going to sort of build a movie around, or how did that happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, really – The idea of isolation is essential, I think, for many of my favorite horror movies, right? You know, The Overlook Hotel, right? And Shining, this feeling that there's nowhere to run. You know, I put some care into sort of setting the stage here in a similar way to we open in the Shining and get the tour of the Overlook. This is the world you're going to be in. We see Dean, who's Bradley Whitford, take Chris on this tour and explain, look, you know, the closest people are past the lake and miles. It's total freedom, we have total autonomy here, which is, of course, you know, a lovely thing for him, but a terrifying idea for a city boy like myself who, you know, when you're out in the country and it's like, okay, so how loud do I have to scream before somebody can get here? Oh, see, there's no bars on this cell phone. What's okay? I'm gonna have to get a Uber on standby because
that is now the ultimate horror, isn't it? The fact that you cannot call somebody on your phone, that you have no reception on your cell phone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's it. And the idea that you can't get out. There's no escape. Wherever you go, it will find you. Which is why, you know, It Follows was so successful. Nightmare on Elm Street has that feeling like, I eventually got to go to sleep.
My guest is director, filmmaker, and dazzling urbanite Jordan Peele. His first film as director is Get Out. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm being tortured and scared to death by a guy who's better known for comedy, Jordan Peele. His first film is right, director, is Get Out. And first of all, the opening is a great sick joke, and I'm not going to give that away. But okay. It's also a play on the kind of – a reverse play on how best to put this? Cultural archetypes we often see in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And –
Well, yeah.
Was that always the way you wanted to start the film, just sort of playing on with expectations? Because the movie's about doing that from start to finish.
Well, you know, no, it wasn't always the way I wanted to start. The first scene in the movie really became apparent as, you know, as we were dealing with these, you know, these true real life racial horrors of the Trayvon, of Mike Brown's murder by police. And it was this realization that this would be a good way to just initially put the audience in the perspective of, you know, the fear of being a black man in a white neighborhood. You know, traditionally you hear about, you know, white people being afraid of black neighborhoods.
Well, and so often that's the case in movies where it's a white protagonist in a black neighborhood.
That's right. And so I thought if I can start with that very real fear of being villainized – for no reason, that the audience would get it and feel it and feel like they were able to go into the rest of the film feeling this fear that is kind of, you know, intrinsic to my African American experience.
Mine as well.
Yeah.
And I don't want you to feel singular here, Jordan.
Yeah.
But
right.
I mean, there's even like even the car, because the car is almost like a quote from Risky Business. It's the old Porsche from.
That's right. That's right. You know, there's a lot of little, you know, pieces of.
Well, nods to other films, I say.
Yeah, and also little pieces of whiteness. Things that may, you know, black people may or may not feel kind of alienated or excluded by, you know, the lacrosse stick. You know, hey, there's plenty of black lacrosse players, but
Jim Brown,
Jim Brown, right? And you know, bocce ball, you know, these little
things that say you don't belong.
These little things that say you don't belong. Taxidermy, you know, these are things that, like, you know, I don't know, like, I don't, I just don't. I'm guessing that most people who indulge in taxidermy or white. I don't mean to generalize. I might be wrong there, but yeah, it was about, you know, bingo. You know, things you won't find at the barbecue, Elvis. Look, I took the satirical notes from the Stepford Wives, which has a great satire.
It's our 11th satirizing like middle class Connecticut suburbia.
That's right, and the relationship and gender. And, you know, that movie, I'm able to watch that movie with glee and joy and fear and not walk away from it feeling sort of villainized as a man because of the power of the story. So that movie really helped me understand that it was possible to make this movie without being a complete assault or to be completely unfair.
But there are also so many great notes struck. I mean, I want to ask you, too, how you found Chris, I mean, how you found your lead, because I wonder at some point if you thought about starring in it yourself.
You know, I didn't. I'm not very good of an actor, as it turns out. Yeah, well, hey.
What's that?
Look,
really?
If I could do what – yeah, that I mean, if I could do what Daniel Kaluuya does, I would be doing it, Elvis. I mean, this guy is – he is such a special actor and – you know, one of the, you know, talk about representation. One of the crazy things you figure out when you're starting to make a movie like this as a 26-year-old male black lead. And, you know, producers like, hey, so, you know, it'd be great if you can get a star in this film. And it's like, okay, who's gotten the opportunity, you know? Yeah, there's like Michael B. Jordan, right, is out there. There's a couple of great talents.
Glover, once you go for the four
Donald
people.
Donald Glover.
Yeah, who are too busy to do it, then what do you do?
Chad Boswick. Yeah. And, you know, it's part of what makes this film, I think, necessary is the fact that we do have actors like Daniel Kaluuya who are should-be movie stars. And I know he will continue to be after this, but he deserves to be the lead of a film, not the black best friend. And I do, you know, on the topic of horror and celebrity, you know, I am a firm believer that, you know, celebrity kind of it can have a negative effect on horror unless it's done very right. The best horror feels grounded, it feels real, and celebrity can be a distracting sort of factor. So the fact that I sort of lucked into, you know, Bradley and Catherine who reached out into this movie wasn't even by intention. It was this, you know, I wasn't looking for, you know, to cast recognizable people out of the gate. I was very, you know, but, you know, when I found that they were an option, you know, you can't turn down because they're, you know, two of the best actors we have. It's, you know, they were perfect for the role and amazing. But I was never in the school of thought that, like, let's populate – this will gain momentum if we populate it with known entities.
But I guess I was trying to talk, too, about the clarity of the images. I mean, and there's a real – It looks really good, and that's part of the promise too of a nightmare. Is that things look really sharp,
mm-hmm.
and they're really clear, and there's something really unsettling about that when there's that much detail being offered.
Yeah, and I mean the best horror movies, of course, are beautiful,
like Rosemary's Baby, for example, or all that stuff you're talking about in The Stepford Wives, all that sort of those gorgeous manicured lawns, mm-hmm. and nobody around as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, and the contrast of the idyllic surrounding with where you know it's going to go. I'm not the type of horror creator who's going to make a dusty old house with paint chipping off, and it's like this is a Halloween haunted house. This is where horror movies are meant to take place. That's not my style, because I'm so intrigued with how you can get horror from revelation, from suspense, from terror, and you know my very favorites, you know, are beautiful.
But there is a thrill in seeing a black figure in the center of a horror movie. I mean, there's something about that because it's still, you know, it's the undiscovered country, basically, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we've had a Night of the Living Dead, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah, 50 years ago this year.
This year. Guess who's coming to dinner 50 years ago this
Absolutely.
Year.
Yeah, and it's covering another horror movie in the heat of the night, which is 50 years ago.
This year?
Yeah.
Wow, that was a good year for black people.
Black people by themselves.
by themselves. Black people going up against it. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's like we still have to, most of the people still have to be white, but at least we can have black people in the film. That is new. But then, you know, kind of never again for a long time. It's almost like that checked that box and we moved on from it. You know, we've got People Under the Stairs with Fool. We've got, you know, Candyman, where the monster is black, and you know a few other, different titles. But
if I had the protagonist, the object of sympathy, be a person of color, is still unusual. I mean, and we saw what happened in Night of the Living Dead, for God's sakes, and then that was, by the way, I'd never revisited any of the movies after that.
One of the, you know, myths that has perpetuated this whole lack of representation is this feeling that black protagonists don't sell, that especially overseas,
sure.
it's a non-starter. Straight Outta Compton, F. Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton, bitch slapped that theory in the face, said, look, you know, good movies work. That was a wake-up call, and now
and also black culture has a place. It's basically an inextricable part of popular culture around the world, not just the United States.
Yes. And that, you know, the power of story is that, you know, humans, we are all the same. We can see through each other's eyes if given the opportunity. And I think, you know, that mythology that says, okay, it's a risk to give a black artist a platform is what has kept black artists from striving for this goal and having the confidence to develop this work. I've been on TV for, you know, the last 10 years. I didn't think this film was possible. I didn't think they'd ever let me make it or do it. I thought it was too dangerous. I believed the myth that it was...
Even living inside the eye of the hurricane, you still sort of bought this... I mean, at some point you hear it enough, you don't think past it anymore, right?
Yeah, you go, okay, right, okay, well, I guess that's a problem. If it can't travel overseas, that's bullshit.
But it's also this thing that I said to you in the first half, and I think it's so much of the black experience in its truest form is about that, be it hip-hop or jazz or whatever. It's about, and you made a horror film about it, in effect, about enforced self-awareness. You can't be, you can't afford to be not self-aware if you're a person of color. And the idea of building a piece of material around that and not just making it comedy so we can sort of laugh it off, but sort of saying that it's a justifiable fear, I think is a remarkable thing for a movie to do.
Well, thank you. I agree. And because of this, you know, when I set out to write this movie, it wasn't, I'm gonna make this movie. When I set out to write this movie, I said, you know what? You know, screw everybody else, screw Hollywood, screw it all. I want to become a better writer. I want to have something that I can have fun writing. I want to write a movie that, if it would be produced, which it won't because it's impossible, it would be my favorite movie. And so with that sort of notion, I was able to defy my own boundaries and step into this very, what I would have thought of as an unsafe zone for, you know, writing, you know, working hard on something that would ultimately sit in my computer for the rest of time. But, you know, I was very just, you know, so you can imagine how surreal this is now to say, look, it worked. All it took was a little bit of faith. And in my situation, it was manufactured faith, right? Because it wasn't that I actually believed it had a place. It was like, you know, I don't need to feel the doubt because I'm giving my permission to write something for myself.
I wish we had more time to talk because it's a fascinating movie. Because finally, it's what the best horror movies are, which are movies about ideas. And wow, it's a smart, funny movie. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Jordan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. My guest, who better go back to comedy soon, is Jordan Peele. He's made a terrific first film. It's Get Out. A recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yo. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm terrified. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.